morning. My name is Mark Silver, and I am a forensic expert working in New York City. I've done about 2,000 cases. I've been in practice since 2002, predominantly working for immigration lawyers, but also criminal lawyers, personal injury lawyers, and so on. I'm a lawyer in New York State, but I'm also a clinical psychiatric social worker licensed, and I have a doctorate in psychology. And what I've been doing since I left law school is undertaking forensic family and mental health evaluations for immigration and criminal lawyers. I've really covered a wide range of issues over the years, but really this is among my most favorite topics because of its complexity and because of the extremely important day-to-day applicability for criminal defense lawyers. The name of the topic today is borderline personality disorder, : pre-plea and pre-sentence criminal mitigation strategies. It's really my hope to integrate theory and practice, and I strongly encourage criminal defense lawyers today to email me at marksilver1@cs.com and put the word borderline sample in the subject line and tell me about yourself. Put your name, your address, phone number, and so on, your information as a criminal defense lawyer. And I say that because I unfortunately get a lot of spam, and I want to make sure I have an email from a legitimate source. I'm not going to send you emails about anything. I don't care who you are, honestly. I just want to make sure it's a real criminal defense lawyer. But the reason I'm sending this sample is so you can really understand how the material I'm presenting today in a theoretical way pertains and really can be enmeshed with a real fact pattern from a real case and cases that I guarantee you'll be seeing in your own practice. The idea here is to understand the clinical issues related to a specific mental health issue. Today we're working with borderline personality disorder, and understand how the criteria of that mental health issue dovetail extremely well with the criminal defendant's behavior, thinking patterns, feelings, emotions, and so on. I have a specific chapter on borderline personality disorder for criminal defense lawyers in my book. The book is called Handbook of Mitigation in Criminal and Immigration Forensics, and the subtitle is Humanizing the Client Towards a Better Legal Outcome. And that's really what I do in all my criminal mitigation cases, and specifically here, because these clients are so fragile and vulnerable, as we'll see. To humanize the client, to really allow the reader of the report, whether it's a prosecutor or the judge, to understand the challenges, the hardships, the developmental problems that this particular client has had to contend with in childhood, adolescence, and adulthood, given their particular mental health issues, and in what way it has affected their thinking, their behavior, and so on. I'm literally updating this book as we speak. It should be available for the 7th edition in perhaps as early as 1 or 2 months. But please don't hesitate to look at the new edition, and if you wish to email me, and I'll send you a sample redacted, as I noted. Just so you understand, a redacted sample, I'm sure most criminal defense lawyers are aware, means that relevant personal information regarding the client has been omitted and replaced by non-identifying information. If you want to look at a wide range of different criminal mitigation case samples for individuals with a wide range of problems and issues in a wide range of situations, please look at criminal mitigation case studies for criminal defense lawyers, as I have on the slide. It's in the 2nd edition. It's right now only available with lulu.com. They were the publishers. My other three books, as you can see from my website and from here, are available on amazon.com. The advantage of the second book, Criminal Mitigation Case Studies, is that you can really compare and contrast a very wide range of cases and how criminal mitigation can be applied quite broadly, depending on the client's particular issues, background, the challenges for the criminal defense lawyer, and so on. I really work in a wide range of specialty areas for criminal mitigation. These include white-collar crime, sex crimes, complex trauma, borderline personality disorder, as we'll look at today, traumatic backgrounds, clients with criminal immigration problems, difficult clients. We see a lot in white-collar cases. In particular, those are clients that tend to jeopardize their case by not listening to their criminal defense lawyer. They tend to undermine the case progress in one way or another. I think it's really important to look at specialty areas within criminal mitigation, both understanding criminal mitigation holistically, but then understanding how the particular strategies of criminal mitigation for defense lawyers can really pertain to particular kinds of situations. And so we have these other CLEs to complement the more general one. A good place to start in this area is a review of the definition of criminal mitigation. Criminal mitigation is a biopsychosocial evaluation of the client's social and psychological history, informed by the facts of the criminal case, with appropriate recommendations as a means to minimize the negative legal outcome, either in court or with a prosecutor. Mitigating circumstances reduces the degree of moral culpability or blame, which in fairness, sympathy, or mercy may lead to a more favorable outcome for the defendant. And with this definition, I want to give you a real life example that's in the redacted case sample that I can send you. And we're going to apply this real case to the criteria of borderline personality disorder within the slides of the CLE, and understand how criminal mitigation was extremely helpful for this individual. The individual was a criminal defendant, about 35 years old. She was raising her 8-year-old daughter on her own. She is a New Yorker, lived on the West Side with her parents. Her grandparents and parents were survivors of the Holocaust, that is the racist destruction against the Jews during the Second World War. They immigrated to the safety of the United States, where they did very well. Her father became a physician. Her mother engaged generally in healthy hobbies and activities, and the family seemed to be doing well. The client had finished college, and she was working in her father's medical office. Over many, many months, she stole her father's prescription pads, forged his signature, and gave the prescription pads to her boyfriend, who was addicted to drugs. It's an extremely serious case for many reasons. First, this is not an uncommon criminal behavior, but it's rarely caught. So when the prosecutor gets a hold of a case like this, they really want to make an example. Second, the client had unfortunately stolen not just a few prescription sheets, but many, many prescription pads over many months or even years. And it resulted in her boyfriend selling these prescription pads to drug dealers on the streets, which was, of course, very serious as well. So she looked like she grew up in a upper middle class, a professional family, an educated woman. And yet she had committed a rather serious crime and was looking at quite a lengthy period of incarceration. And what we really needed to do in this case was to lift up her home and look inside and look at her history in a very detailed and honest way to understand that this was a woman who, in fact, had suffered a long history of very serious trauma as a second-generation survivor of the Holocaust, a individual who'd grown up in a home with a father who was terribly emotionally and verbally abusive against her because he was contending with his own trauma as a survivor of the Second World War, and that this woman was really horribly traumatized, and it resulted in a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, which very, very much informed her behavior, thinking, and so on. And so getting back to this definition now, It's through the client's biopsychosocial history and an understanding of her clinical issues that we come to understand who she is. And this is crucial. I could really spend an entire hour just on this slide. It's not that we're just getting information about who she is, like a journalist might. We're getting clinically informed biopsychosocial background information. That is, we're understanding who she is through a clinical lens, and therefore getting a much better understanding and much greater insight into her decision-making, into why in the world she would sabotage her life, why in the world she would undermine her very positive progress as she's taking care of her 8-year-old daughter as a single mother, why in the world she would do something so harmful to herself and her family for what? I mean, for simply placating her drug-addicted boyfriend who is selling these prescription sheets on the street to drug users who filled them out for painkiller use. So this is a client who superficially looked rather benign in terms of the facts, and yet really there was a huge amount of sympathy and empathy you could feel for her, and her decision-making, her culpability, blame had to be understood within the context of her diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. So let's review the purpose of mitigation. First, to humanize the client through a sympathetic narrative. And this client, again, she did not look very sympathetic at the outset, but when we finished the criminal mitigation case, she looked extremely sympathetic, understanding her clinical issues and family background history. We want to induce empathy for the reader. Again, the prosecutor had no empathy for this woman whatsoever. And yet after the criminal defense lawyer had presented the issues to the criminal defense lawyer, to the prosecutor's office, given what he understood clinically from the mitigation report, of course, it became very sympathetic. We wanted to document the client's life history to explain that her problems started not when she was a teenager, not when she was a child. Problems started before she was born because her parents and grandparents had suffered traumas as a result of the issues in the Holocaust. So she was coming into this world already within the context of a very, very traumatized family. Contextualize the client's conduct. Extremely important to contextualize why she stole the prescription pads and why she provided them to her drug-addicted boyfriend. Stress family's financial, psychological, and financial hardships. Also crucial, looking at the family's interdependence. Illustrate the client's community, educational, employment ties. For all the client's problems, in many ways, she was a responsible mother, working full-time, taking care of her 8-year-old daughter, and not involved with drugs or other negative issues. Express client's remorse and regret. This client was truly remorseful, and she showed real contrition about what she had done. Next, professional expression can replace self-expression. This is extremely important. This client understood her mental health problems in a very, very general way. She could not articulate or really understand the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, although she was quite an individual, she was quite an intelligent individual, but clinically you would not expect her to be able to do that. And so professional expression by a clinical expert doing the mitigation report was very necessary. Next, to show that's not just a mental health report, we're not just saying, you know, she's Looney Tunes because of this diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, quite the opposite. We're saying she has this diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, and please understand that within the context of her development, life, social history, and so on. Single document theory, it's not just that we're trying to give over to the prosecutor a wide range of documents for the case, but within the single criminal mitigation document to provide a concerted and condensed understanding of this client's background and life. Disabuse parties of bias and prejudice, extremely important for these kinds of cases. Because, of course, the prosecutor might be thinking in his or her mind, well, you know, if she stole prescription pads from her father's office, maybe she had stolen prescription pads from 10 other offices, and we want to disabuse the prosecutor of that. We want to dispel non-existent patterns of behavior. And very, very importantly, and I have a completely different CLE on this, is to counter the government's pre-sentence investigation report, because that would clearly not bring out or have an appreciation for the client's history of mental health issues, specifically psychopathology with regard to the borderline personality disorder. So what is a personality disorder? A personality disorder is an enduring pattern of inner experience and behavior that deviates from the norm of the individual's culture. The pattern is seen in two or more of the following areas: cognition, affect, interpersonal functioning, and impulse control. Cognition refers to how we process information, how we understand the world. Affect refers to our mood. Interpersonal functioning speaks for itself. It concerns how we interact with those around us, not just within our home, but within the workplace, larger community, and so on. And impulse control, which refers to decisions and behaviors we undertake without thinking, that is, in a knee-jerk reaction manner. The enduring pattern is inflexible and pervasive across a broad range of social and personal and social situations. It typically leads to significant distress or impairment in social, work, or other areas of functioning. The pattern is stable and of long duration, and its onset can be traced back to early adulthood or adolescence. That's a general definition of personality disorder. There are, in fact, a wide range of personality disorders that are actually very relevant to criminal defense work. In the years that I've been doing this for criminal defense lawyers, both writing, undertaking evaluations and writing reports, doing the criminal mitigation, and just interviewing people in general for criminal defense lawyers for consultative purposes and so on, I rarely see an awareness by prosecutor's office, judges, or criminal defense lawyers regarding personality disorders, even though they're much more prevalent than we think, and we'll look at statistics hopefully later if we have the chance. But there's a wide list of them, and as you can see, they're probably not very well known or understood by most criminal defense lawyers. These can be really devastating to the individual. They can fundamentally affect in a negative way the person's behavior and feelings and interpersonal relationships and moods and so on. The one we're going to focus on today is borderline personality disorder, but the others really have significant impact on our clients and given our clients' particular issues and how they got themselves into trouble. So first I want to give an overview of borderline personality disorder, and this information comes directly from the National Institute of Health. The National Institute of Health have great websites with specific information and descriptions of mental health issues, but also medical issues. It's very clear. It's written in a way that I think anybody can understand, and I really wanted to provide it for you as well. So the main feature of borderline personality disorder is a pervasive pattern of instability in interpersonal relationships, self-image, and emotions. Self-image is extremely important. It refers to how a person understands himself, their self-confidence, their self-esteem, and so on. People with borderline personality disorder are also usually very impulsive, oftentimes demonstrating self-injurious behaviors, that is, risky behaviors, including cutting, and even suicide attempts. Borderline personality disorder occurs in most people by early adulthood. The unstable pattern of interacting with others has persisted for years and is usually closely related to the person's self-image and early social interactions. And for many, many of these clients, the issues go back not just to early adulthood, but really adolescence. The pattern is present in a variety of settings, not just at work or home, and often is accompanied by a similar lability, that is, fluctuating moods back and forth within a person's life. These individuals are very sensitive to environmental circumstances. The perception of impending separation or rejection, or the loss of external structure, can lead to profound changes in self-image, affect, cognition, and behavior. They experience intense abandonment fears and inappropriate anger, even when faced with a realistic time-limited separation or when there are unavoidable changes in plans. For example, sudden despair in reaction to a clinician's announcing the end of the hour, panic or fury when someone important to them is just a few minutes late or must cancel an appointment. They may believe that this abandonment, in quotes, implies that they are bad. These abandonment fears are related to an intolerance of being alone and need to have other people with them. And from this we can see, and we'll look at it more within the specific criteria, how this plays exactly into our client's relationship with her drug-addicted boyfriend, on how her low self-esteem, her dependence on that drug-addicted boyfriend, on how he was able to manipulate and coerce her, very much fed into her decision to steal these prescription pads from her father's medical office. Finally, relationships and the person's emotions may sometimes be seen by others as characterized as being shallow. What I want to do now for a good half hour is look at the specific criteria of borderline personality disorder and how it pertains to our specific client. These are broadened criteria that I use when I teach because I think it's much more inclusive and much more explanatory. So the first is frantic efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment. That is, the client will feel that being alone is intolerable. The client will feel that they have an almost paranoid sense that those who love them, those who they think they can trust, are going to leave them alone, so they're going to be separated. The client may engage in drama or attention-seeking behavior to keep someone around. They have a deep need for being loved. This is exactly what we see with our client. She's in this very self-destructive relationship with a drug-addicted boyfriend, but she has such a deep fear of being alone because of the trauma that she inherited from her parents and grandparents post-Holocaust. She has such a deep fear of separation that she engages in attention-seeking behavior with this drug-addicted boyfriend who clearly does not have her best interest at heart, just so she has someone that she can hold on to that she feels will be a more permanent relationship. Is it a healthy relationship? No, it's a very unhealthy relationship. It's very destructive. Nonetheless, she keeps her family at arm's length because of the history of abuse and destructive behavior that she experienced in early childhood. And she adopts, in contrast, this much more destructive relationship with a drug-addicted boyfriend, but one in which she feels that she has some sense of control. The next criteria is a pattern of unstable and intense personal relationships. This is characterized by alternating between extremes of idealization and devaluation. The individual may rely on others to regulate them. That means that the individual really does not have a very strong sense of their own needs and their own identity, and they rely on others to help define who they are. Next, the clients may respond disproportionately, that is rapidly, meaning that the client is very hypersensitive. And in fact, that's what we see with this client. We see a client with a long history of unstable relationships. This client is now in this destructive relationship with her drug-addicted boyfriend, but the fact is she has had hundreds and hundreds of sexual partners over the years. And she's had these destructive, unimportant, superficial sexual relationships exactly because they're superficial, exactly because the intense instability of these relationships, which would seem destructive and very bizarre to normal people, to someone with borderline personality disorder, feeds in to help regulating their identity and self-esteem and so on. She's also, when she becomes overwhelmed in these relationships, emotionally, personally, or whatever, because they're superficial, she's able to cut them off. In other words, she feels such a lack of control in her own life that the only way she's able to control things externally are through these superficial, destructive relationships, and that's what we see with her drug-addicted boyfriend. The difference, of course, in this particular relationship, she didn't know that the drug-addicted boyfriend would also be able to control and manipulate her to the point that he's coercing her into obtaining these prescription pads from her father's medical office. Next is identity disturbance, and many of these overlap, of course, to some degree, but identity disturbance refers to, you know, significant and persistent unstable self-image. It's not only that the individual does not have a strong sense of their own identity and positive self-esteem, but, you know, they really have an unstable self-image. That is, sometimes they think that they're capable, and other times they feel extremely worthless. You know, at sometimes they take up a particular hobby and they think they're doing well, and, you know, 3-4 weeks later, they, you know, after practicing guitar or practicing piano for a few weeks or a few months and they've really made some gains, they throw away that hobby because they feel that it doesn't complement who they are. This is a very, very serious problem. I mean, you can imagine if you yourself did not have a strong sense of your own identity, of who you are, of your needs and issues, of your values. Many of these clients, as a result, engage in what's called projective identification. That is, they vicariously contend with their personal issues interpersonally. So my client, for example, you know, she has a very profound sense of disappointment in her family because of the abuses she suffered as a child, and a profound sense of anger. And she becomes very overwhelmed with her feelings. And so what does she do? She gets into these destructive relationships, as she has now with her drug-addicted boyfriend. And of course, her drug-addicted boyfriend also has problems. He also grew up in a family where there was destructive behaviors and abuses and so on. And she is able to deal with her anger, her disappointments in her family, her sadness about her history, not directly, but vicariously through the issues that her boyfriend is contending with. And we sometimes see this with codependent individuals in alcoholic relationships. This also leads to poor ego boundaries, as I have on the slide. That is, with many of these individuals, it's hard for them to tell where they stop and where other people start and where they stop and other people start. In other words, they have diffuse individual ego boundaries. They very much latch onto and identify with other people, even though those other people may have very, very different values and histories and issues and so on and so forth. So because of this, she was very easily influenced by her drug-addicted boyfriend's request for the prescription pads to sell for drug sales. Next, impulsivity. People who make rational, calm decisions with regard to their work, and of course professionals do this, you know, have a case as a criminal defense lawyer, you have to think, what is the best strategy, motion practice, when do I approach the prosecutor, how do I speak with my client about these matters and the family. You work in a very concerted, proactive way. People with impulsivity, it's hard to understand. They make their decisions often based on zero thought, on knee-jerk reactions, and it occurs often in contexts of spending money, self-damaging acts with regard to substance abuse, impulsive sexual relationships, reckless driving, binge eating, and so on. These are people that it looks like they live on the edge, but they're really not living on the edge as much as they're impulsive. And I'll give you a contrast. A very dangerous hobby, of course, is a rock climbing in the United States. And many rock climbers in recent years have suffered terrible injuries and even death. It's different than impulsivity. People that are doing the rock climbing understand the risks. They think out how they're going to approach the cliff, strategies, tools, and whatever. It may be a dangerous behavior, but it's not an impulsive behavior. Impulsive behaviors occur when there is no thought-out mechanism, no real concerted concern for the actual behavior and the outcome or consequences. And often they're very self-damaging. In other words, you can climb rocks for years and years and not suffer any damage, whereas these behaviors and impulsivity are by definition damaging. And this client, although she had no history of substance abuse or issue about spending money, she was taking care of her daughter in a somewhat, you know, generally responsible manner. She had no driving issues. Her eating was generally healthy, although she was somewhat overweight. For her, the impulsivity issue was in the context of sex. And as I mentioned, she had hundreds of superficial sexual relationships, they lasted, you know, for literally just an hour or two, you know, maybe a day or a week or so, and that was it. And this is how she found her drug-addicted boyfriend. You know, it was one of these impulsive decisions, and unfortunately for her, he was equally, you know, disturbed in his own way with his own personality disorder issues and his drug addiction, and she fell into this trap. And but for her impulsive relationship to meet this man, she would never have engaged in the behaviors of stealing the prescription pads. Next, recurrent suicidal behavior. These are gestures, threats of possible self-mutilating behavior. Self-mutilating behavior is usually done very superficially on the arms or forearms. With adolescents, it's often done on the thighs so that parents and teachers can't see it. Some of these clients really feel that self-cutting regulates emotions, it alleviates empty feelings, and it provides psychological and even physical relief. Some of these clients would just as soon be dead, and they need someone else to really affirm their need to be alive. These clients have terrible self-anger, self-hatred. Some clients feel that they are punishing themselves, they're being punished for perceived wrongs. This client indeed had a long history of superficial cutting on her arms and legs, but in general, she's engaged in rather destructive and dangerous behaviors. She never threatened to kill herself specifically, but the self-cutting and self-mutilation has to be understood in this context. And clearly, one of the problems here is that over the years, her parents and family members became aware of her borderline behaviors and suicidal threats.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is LOW, L-O-W, all lowercase, LOW. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is LOW, L-O-W, all lowercase, LOW. Please take a moment and write this down.
So on in a benign way. And they distanced themselves from her, of course. They became frightened. They didn't know how to deal with it. And of course, they're dealing with their own issues of trauma, you know, as first generation immigrants to the United States, having survived their problems in Europe. And so if you're really dealing with an entire family where there are individual and cumulative issues. Some of these clients are also actually quite suicidal outright. And that really has to be understood in two ways. Passive and active. Passive suicidality occurs when a person says, you know, I wonder what it would be like if I would just sleep and sleep and sleep and never wake up, so I would die. That's a passive suicidal statement. An active suicidal statement or thought occurs when the individual has a specific plan, for example, taking a significant overdose of Tylenol so that they won't be alive anymore. And that should be asked about as well. The next criteria is emotional instability. This is extremely important. It refers to clients who are unable to regulate their own mood, their own affect. The emotional instability can be quite intense, with highs and lows, and some of these clients can actually look like they're bipolar, but it's a completely separate diagnosis and separate issues. In particular, clients with bipolar often have grandiosity and so on, and these clients do not. These clients, in fact, feel a rather, they experience terribly low self-esteem and often feel very, very inadequate, as we'll get to. these clients, because of their emotional instability, can also have skewed perceptions. They have very black and white thinking. They may respond to situations with terrible rage. They have very strong reactions, especially when they're under stress. This emotional dysregulation means that it's very hard for them to focus, and it's very hard for them to make rational and thought out decisions. And clearly this also plays into the other criteria of impulsivity and so on. So this client, when she's interacting with her family or when she becomes frustrated with issues in her life, she reacts with terrible rage. And because of that, no one wants to deal with her. No one wants to say, I guess you're having a bad day. Can we talk about it? Or, perhaps we can go as a family to seek mental health counseling. That is not possible with these kinds of clients, except really with concerted effort. And clearly that was what was going on for this client. And it's very important to understand that, many of these clients, when you see them, and this is a big issue for criminal defense lawyers, they come to the office and they're dealing with the criminal defense lawyers, telling their story, telling their history, and they seem quite stable. They seem like they're providing a clear narrative of their history. But it doesn't really explain what goes on in their everyday lives. That is, many of these clients can look quite stable, and it's very important to understand that many of these clients have jobs, and they have families, and hobbies and interests, but it doesn't mean that they're not dealing with emotional instability internally. The next criteria is chronic feelings of emptiness. And if you don't know what this is, it's very hard to conceptualize, but it's individuals who have an empty internal world. Many of these clients devalue themselves. They feel a sense of worthlessness and helplessness. And as a result of that, their everyday lives are very empty and sad. It's very pathetic. Paradoxically, because of this, some of these clients really have a deep sense of entitlement and even power, because they feel so powerless. When you feel so powerless and you have such low self-esteem, you need a great deal to fill that void. And unfortunately, you're filling the void with that emptiness with meaningless or self-destructive behaviors and so on. And very often, with our client, unhealthy relationships. She contends with her internal emotional world of emptiness and her psychological problems with these very superficial, unhealthy relationships, which really do help her in a very temporary way. But of course, they're unhealthy because they place her at risk. The sexual relationships place her at risk for many reasons. Obviously, they're short term. She doesn't know who she's going to be meeting with these one night stands. And of course, she meets a lot of losers and dangerous people. And that's how she got into this long term relationship with her drug addicted boyfriend. She feels so terrible about herself, so empty. She's only able to contend with that by being with people who are even more empty and feel more powerless. And this, in some way, helps to fill that terrible void in her life. Next, inappropriate intense anger. This also dovetails with the emotional instability that I noted before. These are clients with a difficulty controlling anger. They frequently become very upset. They can have rages. They can even have recurrent physical fights. They can be very hypersensitive to everything and everyone around them. There may be perceived rejection that precipitates a bout of intense anger. There could be chronic discontentment due to lack of security, lack of stability and safety in their lives. And they always seem to be at war with the world. They're always at war with the world with one particular issue or one particular problem. And that particular issue or problem seems to fall by the wayside. And 2 weeks later and 2 months later, they have a new issue, a new problem, a new person that they're angry at. And having intense anger all the time and hypersensitivity really makes it impossible to develop healthy relationships and to think through your problems in a normal and safe manner. And then we see that, of course, with this client, who's unable to think through her problems because of her intense anger, And for at least this client, which is often precipitated by perceived rejection. Next is transient stress-related paranoid thoughts. This is extremely important, and I want to say something in general about this. Criminal defense lawyers think of psychosis within the purview predominantly of schizophrenia, and of course, because of the concern for defense of insanity, that is, a psychosis. Psychosis is generally characterized by two main things: hallucinations, which are false perceptions, and delusions, which are false beliefs. But really, psychosis is a phenomenon that you can find much more broadly within mental health in a wide range of areas, including, for example, depression. It's quite common within depression. It's also a criteria that is found here in borderline personality disorder, where the person can have paranoid thoughts. They can feel very suspicious, guarded. They have a low sense of trust in others. And they often have a very low sense of trust in themselves. That is, they're almost paranoid about their own judgment. They don't trust themselves. In some cases, there can even be severe dissociative symptoms. So it's very important to understand that it's not just that the client's thinking and ability to think through problems is not as it should be, but there's psychosis that's actually going on. And there's also psychosis in schizotypal, which is the second personality disorder that I noted in an earlier slide. So it really pops up in different places. And again, it's not at all obvious that this person has psychotic ideation, and therefore it needs to be asked about by someone who has a clinical understanding about this within the context of the mitigation evaluation. I see this quite frequently, because I've dealt with hundreds and hundreds of trauma cases, predominantly spouses who have been abused in the context of the home, that is domestic violence. And I've seen this many, many times, individuals who have suffered trauma as victims of human rights violations and persecution in their country of origin. And they become very distressful. Why? Because they're very hypervigilant. They're always looking over their shoulder, they're always fearful. You also see this in people who have been to prison, who have to be hypervigilant, looking over their shoulder to remain safe. This is a very important area, and it reflects psychosis for the person with borderline personality disorder. Cognitive dysregulation, which is the next area, is not in the DSM, but I'm putting it here because I think it's important. Many of the clients with borderline personality disorder really have difficulty processing information because of all the other criteria that I've noted. They can have confusion, they can have real disorganization in their daily lives, they can have inattention and poor focus, and they sometimes look like they have ADHD. Their thoughts can be chronically preoccupied with their mental health issues, with the criteria noted earlier. And because of this, as I noted, it's really hard for them to think through problems in a mature and healthy manner. And this is a woman who has a good head on her shoulders. You know, she's doing other things right. She, despite terrible obstacles, she's taking care of her daughter in a healthy manner, and the daughter is going to school and doing well. She lives with people who are generally safe, and she lives in the same home very consistently for many years. She's working every day. She's not spending irresponsibly and so on. But in other ways, it's hard for her to deal with certain stressful situations. Because of her mental health issues. And when she gets in this disruptive relationship with her boyfriend, she's unable to properly think through the consequences and what it means to be in a relationship with someone who leads such a dangerous lifestyle because of his own addiction to drugs. And his encouragement and persuasive, controlling, manipulative behavior getting her to steal these prescription pads from her father's medical office. The last thing I want to say is that there's something called quiet borderline. It's something I've really only learned in the last 4 or 5 years. And that is, you know, just as people who are depressed are not always crying and they're not always feeling hopeless, and many people with severe depression are able to sleep and they have a good appetite, so too with borderlines. You know, it's not that every single borderline you're going to see or manifest in these kinds of situations are extremely unstable and so on. Many of them are contending with their mental health issues in a quiet way. That is, they look depressed, but they're dealing with these issues in a quiet way. It doesn't mean that their internal world and what's going inside their hearts and their heads don't reflect the criteria noted above. And clearly, that's an issue for many of our clients. They're quite unable to articulate their mental health problems and to explain what's going on in their hearts and their psychological issues and their decision making. These clients are kind of quiet and they seem depressed, as I noted, but really they may be what's called a quiet borderline, and that's something that should be considered very seriously. The prognosis is generally very good. Research has shown that outcomes can be quite good for people with this disorder, particularly if they're engaged in ongoing therapy. With specialized therapy, most people with borderline personality disorder find their symptoms are reduced and their lives are improved. Although not all symptoms may ease, there is often a major decrease in problem behaviors and suffering. Under stress, some symptoms may come back. When this happens, people with BPD should return to therapy and other kinds of support. And many individuals with BPD experience a decrease in their impulsive behaviors in their 40s. In other words, we want to really emphasize that there are specific treatments and specific hopes that one can look forward to, not just for the family, but in obviously explaining this matter to the courts for our clients. This is something I found that I want to share with you. It just reflects how deeply disturbed some of these clients are, and it really dovetails on the quiet borderline slide. Many of these clients will say, "I'm fine," and it really means I'm not fine. It means I really need help. Some of these clients will say, "I'm just tired," and what they really mean is, "I just can't take it anymore. My internal world is so chaotic. I'm so depressed." A great example is, "I'm just cold." So they're wearing long sleeves, and what they're really saying is, "I don't want you to see my scars." They say, "I'm better. I promise I'm better. I'm doing okay." What they really mean is, "I've never been this bad." So many of these clients are unable to sufficiently articulate their issues. They may be embarrassed, ashamed. They may be very emotionally overwhelming. And so they say things to friends and family members and even professionals. And because of this, the professional or family member may not be able to immediately pick up on the seriousness of the problem. And this is communication dysfunction. The client, the individual, is not able to relate their issues, and it's the job of the professional to unearth them. I have from the NIH also a couple really good slides on explaining abandonment issues, intense, unstable relationships, and identity disturbance. I won't read them for lack of time, but I did want to include them so that the person watching the CLA today could really gain a more detailed understanding about these three issues, which are so crucial. I explained them and I gave examples, but I think it could be helpful to read on your own. Demographics is extremely important. 75% of these individuals are female, but that means, if you do the math, 25% are males, and those individuals are often missed. Why? Because the males are often viewed as dangerous. They're often viewed as having a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder or psychopathy, when in fact they have this diagnosis and they're misdiagnosed. More importantly, between 1.6 and 5.9% of the population have this. But if it's about in the upwards of 6% of the population have this, then you can imagine that it's probably a much larger percentage within the office and referrals for a criminal defense lawyer. So it's something we really, really, really need to have on our radar every day. About 10% end in death because of suicidality. Many of these clients have been the victims of abuse. Many of these clients have secondary problems very much related to their immediate issues, including drugs and other self-destructive behavior. And I often, you know, tell criminal defense lawyers, test yourself. When is the last time you had a client that you recognize as having borderline personality disorder and using that as a core of your criminal mitigation for the purpose of pre-plead with a prosecutor or pre-sentence with a judge? The answer should be relatively often. If almost 6% of individuals have this diagnosis, even if it's half, even if it's 3%, within our criminal defendant population that we see, we should be seeing this on a somewhat regular basis, at least a few times a year. Many of these clients, as I noted, have concomitant issues at the same time, including drugs, alcohol problems, and so on. And these may be over-the-counter drugs as well, even a prescription medication. Severe depression occurs in roughly one-third of all people with borderline personality disorder. Anxiety occurs in at least half of individuals with this disorder. Many of these individuals have eating disorders. My client, I don't know if she had a formal eating disorder, but she was quite overweight. This was a chronic problem, and she was dealing with a lot of her personal issues in this way. Some of these clients may have learning disorders. They may look like they have ADHD because of their inability to focus, their inattention, their cognitive issues, and so on. Many of these clients, because these issues may have occurred in childhood or even adolescence, they may have serious developmental problems. And many of these clients have come from homes where there's family dysfunction, trauma, or abuse or neglect in one form or another. I think this is a crucial slide because borderline personality disorder is perfect for mitigation. It's perfect for criminal mitigation. That is, BPD truly integrates behavior with pathology. If someone is schizophrenic and they're psychotic, they're out of touch with reality because they hear voices and they see things that aren't real and they have delusions that they're all powerful and they commit a crime, the mental health problems that they have don't really explain why they committed a specific crime. It doesn't really buttress it in any way. You're simply explaining that the person's psychotic and therefore they should have a better outcome or perhaps even a defense in full. But with borderline personality disorder, we're actually explaining people's thinking and behaviors and emotions. This woman who steals these prescription pads on behalf of her drug-addicted boyfriend does so specifically because of her diagnosis, because of specific criteria and behaviors that we noted. The client also often, as I mentioned, had concomitant disorders such as drug abuse or whatever, or gambling, whatever it might be. And that also helps to explain what's going on with this particular individual. The community life for these clients are often dysfunctional. Very, very importantly, these clients have fears and anxieties of different kinds. They have a history of chronic problems, not just the problems they have now, but emotional dysregulation and problems in terms of their daily life and hobbies and work. And community and so on. And of course, many of these clients have come from homes when there's been abuse and neglect and so on. These clients have generally a very poor sense of self, but also a very poor sense of self-preservation. That is, their priority is not really taking care of themselves. They're not narcissists in any way, right? They're not self-centered. They don't really have any sense of self at all, in fact. They have a poor sense of self-preservation. That's why this woman, who in some ways is doing well, you know, even with her serious diagnosis, as I said, she's taking care of her 8-year-old daughter and she's working and she's trying to have a life in some way. She's living in a safe home and an environment and so on. She has such a poor sense of self-preservation that when she gets involved with a drug-addicted boyfriend, she has no ability to just say no. Or even after one or two times of stealing these prescription pads from her father, she has no ability to put down her foot and say, no, this is wrong, and I have to move on and cut myself off from this relationship and cut myself off from this behavior. So BPD is perfect for mitigation because it dovetails with specific criteria to the client's actual criminal conduct. It explains decision-making. It contextualizes issues. That's why it's so important. And many of these clients who may appear high-functioning in their daily lives, you scratch underneath the surface, they're so fragile, they're so vulnerable. It really humanizes them and humanizes the pathos. We can really reframe negative behavior into an understanding of who they are given their mental health issues. It's also perfect, BPD is perfect for mitigation because there are specific kinds of treatments, including DBT.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is RAY, R-A-Y, all lowercase, RAY. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is RAY, R-A-Y, all lowercase, RAY. Please take a moment and write this down.
Which stands for dialectical behavior therapy, which is perfect. It's also perfect for dispelling myths and biases and prejudices about the individual who may look very narcissistic, or if it's a male, they may look like they have antisocial personality disorder. Many of these clients can be quite manipulative and coercive, by the way. And again, that may suggest that they're antisocial personality disorder, but really they're not. They're not psychopaths. They have this particular very, very, very serious problem. And it's really evident in the way that they're so self-destructive and how they undermine their own best interests. And it's particularly important, and that's the last point on the slide, when there is more than one criminal defendant involved. And here we have two individuals that are involved, this woman stealing the pads and her drug-addicted boyfriend who is selling them on the streets. Because it really explains why these two are working together and what the client gets out of this ridiculous relationship with this person who really does not care about her at all. So the strategies with BPD stand contrary to traditional mitigation strategies that I have in other CLEs. You know, often in cases we want to say that the client's behavior was aberrant, it was misguided behavior, it was error in judgment, foolish conduct, unthinking moments, and so on. People with BPD have long-standing personal and interpersonal pathology. And so their diminished capacity comes from that. There may be impulsivity, as we noted in an earlier criteria with these individuals, but usually there's a long history of cumulative life stressors that leads to poor judgment. Some of these clients, as I said, because they can be quite manipulative and coercive and so on, seem very bad and evil, and if they're males, again, may be seen as antisocial. But really, we want to show they're not evil. They're very disturbed, they're ill, and this is a real problem that can be helped through mental health counseling. We can also seemingly explain some of their symptoms in a positive way. That is, and I gave a few examples here, there's sensitivity to emotional and social cues. You know, they're very hypersensitive, but it also means that some of these clients can have a great deal of empathy for others at times, and they can have a great deal of sensitivity when other people are suffering. I find that a lot of clients with borderline personality disorder have pets, especially dogs, but also cats. And there's a sense that they have a real sense of the animal's needs, a particular sensitivity that other people don't have. Some of these clients, as I noted, can be quite impulsive and react. There's a lot of reactivity in their lives. But it can also be understood in a positive way in terms of their spontaneity and wishing to love and enjoy life in different ways. And I say this because in every mitigation report, we of course want to put positive things about the individual with regard to their family and community in terms of their hobbies and interests and so on. And this is a good way to do it. We can look at some of their symptoms and really understand them in a positive way. And this occurs with other mental health issues as well. You know, some individuals, for example, who have depression, suffer with terrible insomnia for weeks and months at a time. And for some of those individuals that are living alone, for example, I once had a client who was a writer, actually used those long hours at night when it was very, very quiet to work on his writing and, you know, his drafts of his novels and so on. So sometimes you can understand criteria, not just in a negative way, but in a way that could be positive for that particular individual. You know, I also have a criteria here, their neediness, the borderline's neediness, meaning that our client found it impossible to break off a relationship from this drug-addicted boyfriend because of her neediness, given the criteria noted earlier. But it also means that she has a deep willingness to please. It also means that, you know, she has a deep willingness to help others and so on. I really say this because we don't want to over-pathologize the individual. We don't want to stress in a way that is exaggerating her symptoms. We want to present them as they are and present how it affects her negatively in life and in some sense even positively, in what ways she's doing well, in what ways her life is improving, and in what ways she can redirect her focus in a positive way post-sentencing to be a good community member, to be a good family member, and for her to be, in this particular case, a good mother to her 8-year-old daughter. Many of these clients, I have the slide here, can be very difficult and demanding. These clients seem to undermine strategy by their lawyer. They seem to have never-ending complaints. They never seem satisfied. The criminal defense lawyer may be reported to the bar because the client has called 20, 30 times in a week, even though the same question is asked over and over and the same proper answer is provided by the criminal defense lawyer. Many of these clients may be so exceedingly needy that all the time, energy, and thought of the criminal defense lawyer is being taken up by this one singular client. Many of these clients, because of their poor ego differentiation, may think that their criminal defense lawyer suddenly is their best friend. Some of these clients start off thinking that you are the greatest criminal defense lawyer in the world. They idealize you. And then 2 months later, there's just a small bump within the case and they suddenly devalue their criminal defense lawyer. They think they're the worst person in the world. These are all typical characteristics of borderline personality disorder. And it's extremely important for the lawyer, just like the clinical expert, to monitor countertransference. That is the defense lawyers or the mitigation experts' own feelings and thoughts and emotions with regard to dealing with such a demanding and difficult individual. Because the vast majority of cases are now settled with the prosecutor's office, mitigation is absolutely far and away the most practical and important element in criminal defense, and it's effective in so many fundamental ways. The legal basis for mitigation should always be repeated. Of course, Wiggins v. Smith is the U.S. Supreme Court case that mandated it for penalty, that is death penalty capital cases. But more importantly, in the pre-sentence memorandum of law, it's crucial to interweave the criteria that we have here into key mitigation factors that is outlined in the mitigation report. This will truly afford the prosecutor and judge to consider and understand the client's psychosocial issues as legal mitigating factors rather than simply background information established for the sake of general argument. And that's exactly what we have here. These are key legal mitigating factors given this client's diagnosis of borderline personality and how her presentation explains her behavior, thoughts, feelings, and how she was so easily manipulated by her boyfriend and her consequent criminal behavior. So criminal mitigation is not simply an effective tool for the sake of argument, but a necessary factual underpinning to support the factors in 18 U.S.C. 3553A and other relevant case law. The reality is that post-Booker, you know, the court has unfettered discretion to consider any and all evidence at sentencing. And for borderline personality disorder, I think we have something that really, in an unusual way, explains someone's criminal behavior. As I sometimes note, I parallel this to Gideon v. Wainwright, the crucial 1963 Supreme Court case that mandated a criminal defense for the indigent and poor for serious cases, including felonies, that perhaps we should also a mandate for clients to have a criminal mitigation expert, someone who is able to not only consider their mental health, but their broader psychosocial history by law as a means to understand who they are for the purposes of criminal defense, but just as importantly or more importantly, so that the prosecutor's office and the judge can understand who this individual is. We want to explain that this is not just about psychiatry, it's not just about mental health, but interweaving the client's psychosocial background history with mental health, with a consideration for the client's current context and behavior, because that's what we ultimately want to do in this particular kind of case with borderline personality disorder, to explain the criminal conduct within the context of the pathology, while at the same time not over-pathologizing the individual, but really explaining them as a human with faults and failings and challenges and traumas like everybody else in the world. I have in the last slides mitigation considerations that are so important in every case, but particularly important for people with this kind of mental health issue. I'll just go through them very quickly. What was the client's past like? In other words, especially for this client, her psychosocial history as someone with a background to help better explain how she developed given her borderline personality disorder diagnosis. What role did the client play in this issue and in her life growing up with regard to family, friends, to community? Will the client likely repeat this behavior? Will incarceration promote deterrence? Very important for someone with mental health issues. What will promote justice and promote respect for the law? What will the client's experience be like in jail? This is very important for people with personality disorder, given how they perceive themselves and those around them. Does the client require educational, vocational, medical, or psychiatric assistance? Again, this is a client who requires very specialized kind of mental health support that probably would not be available in any kind of jail. What kind of rehabilitation is needed, and has it already been started? Many of these clients that we see are in therapy. Sometimes the therapy is helpful, sometimes not so helpful, but it's important that there are different kinds of modalities that are certainly available for consideration for these individuals, especially if they have concomitant problems such as depression, alcohol or drug abuse, and so on. Has the client accepted responsibility for his wrongdoing, remorse, and regret? And in this case, the client has a deep sense of contrition, even though she has longstanding interpersonal problems with her parents, and even anger and hatred at times, she feels a deep sense of remorse and clearly understands that what she did was wrong, and she can articulate that. Has restitution already started? Is it possible? It's difficult in this kind of case because of the prescription pads that were stolen, but she fully cooperated. She fully explained what she was doing, and she was obviously able to show her contrition by suggesting who her boyfriend was and his role and how he was selling these prescription pads, making it much more difficult for this to occur in the future. Next, what is a fit punishment? Has the client already been punished in some ways? You know, this client is just an individual who suffered so much in her life, emotionally, physically, interpersonally, and so on. She's been punished in ways that few people will ever understand. She's not going to be able to work in her father's office, obviously, anymore, given the criminal conduct. It's going to be very hard for her to find a job. She's struggling to survive. She's barely keeping her head above water, having to take care of her 8-year-old daughter. What is the least harsh alternative? Are there alternatives to jail that would be better serve the client or family? And again, we're not just thinking of this individual as an individual, but someone who lives within a family and is taking care of her daughter as a single mom. Who will be harmed or protected by the incarceration? What are the family's needs? What will the client's future look like? And again, there can be somewhat of a positive future for this individual with proper therapy and supports. And finally, cumulative mitigating factors. The last thing are the 10 R's of mitigation. I have a separate chapter on this in my book. But again, it's great to use as a superstructure, and I use this, frankly, whenever I do an evaluation. Reality refers to the full narrative, and the full narrative is not just an individual who's stealing prescription pads because her drug-addicted boyfriend needs them. No, a full narrative relates to how she understands herself and her relationships with her father and her relationships with her family and her drug-addicted boyfriend. It's much more nuanced, and the subtleties can be drawn out into several paragraphs rather than just one line explaining all of this in a way that's much more sympathetic. Mens rea, that is intent or volition, that is, what was this woman's decision-making in all this? How did she come to be in such a position? The recency, when it occurred, how often it occurred, and so on. Repetition, this is a woman without a significant criminal record. She's stealing these prescription pads, but you know, it's not a person that we would think would be doing this again, or that has any significant criminal record prior. Rung, how serious is this? Well, it's only prescription pads, but it's really quite serious in the sense that the stealing of prescription pads is rarely caught. and the using and selling of prescription pads is rarely caught. So obviously when the prosecutor got a hold of the case, they considered it in a very, very, very serious manner. On the other hand, you know, it's prescription pads, and it needs to be contextualized in that way. Restorative, has the client righted the wrong in some way? And of course, she's been very cooperative. Rehabilitation, what can be changed? Remorse and regret, we talked about. Does the client understand and accept her actions? And she certainly does. The client's role within the community versus her role within the criminal behavior. And finally, recommendations, you know, what can be fixed and who can be helped. There are many ways to conceptualize cases, and in my general CLE on criminal mitigation, I have a section just on how to undertake and what to consider within the context of a psychosocial history. We're not going to get into it today, but these are super structured questions and criteria that I use myself when I undertake cases. Thank you for listening today. What I've tried to do today is present an overview of borderline personality disorder and really explain how it's a perfect explanation for so many of our clients' behaviors, decision-making, and so on, and how specifically the criteria that is found within the disorder can help explain and defend our clients in a much more professional and complete manner. Thank you very much.